Hello, I'm Brian Morrow, and welcome to The Will to Believe. A number of years ago, I began this podcast with a story about Darwin's bulldog, Thomas Huxley, the grandfather of Aldous Huxley, who pontificated about how unfortunate it was that a beautiful theory can be slain by an ugly fact. Despite his apparent sentimentality, Thomas was in fact infamous for ruining theories with what can only be described as gleeful viciousness. That is the reason he got his nickname, after all. Back when Darwin was still on the boat ride home from the Galapagos, the academic world did not strictly believe that animal species were all direct creations of God. It would be impossible, as a taxonomist, not to begin over centuries to note visual, behavioral, anatomical similarities between various creatures. In fact, the similarity of human brains to those of other primates had, of course, been noted already. There was an existing scientific doctrine that placed intelligent design in a primary position, but accepted that these forms had adapted and diverged into variations ever since their immaculate creation, comparable to a wild garden of countless plant varieties hybridized from a smaller group of original godly seeds, rather than the massive unified tree of the Origin of Species that Darwin was about to upset everybody with. In fact, Erasmus Darwin, Charles's grandfather, was a major figure in this burgeoning idea, which, among other names, was known as transformism. The anatomist Richard Owen used Darwin's findings in the context of this deist view. In fact, Owen and Darwin were of a similar mind about the species discovered on the islands upon Charles's return to England. They would eventually drift apart in a very particular but existentially important matter that would eventually lead to one of the most hilarious disputes of scientific history. Owen synthesized what was going on into the conclusion that, yeah, Darwin was basically right about animals all evolving from each other. However, mankind was God's work, not transmuted from apes or anyone else. And though there are a lot of similarities between humans and apes, the proof is in their brains. There's clearly a lot of psychological and cultural layers to dig into here about why it would be so important to keep humans bounded off in the territory of God's creations, even as we consign the rest of the animal kingdom to being fancy protoplanktons. But we're not here for that right now. We're here for angry scientists. And here I'll just quote Wikipedia because I don't think I could phrase it any better myself. While Owen conceded the all-pervading similitude of structure, every tooth, every bone, strictly homologous, which made it difficult for anatomists to determine the difference between man and ape, he based his new classification on three characteristics which to him distinguished mankind's highest form of brain, the most important being his claim that only the human brain has a hippocampus minor. To Owen in 1857, this feature, together with the extent to which the posterior lobe projected beyond the cerebellum, and the presence of the posterior horn, were how man, quote, fulfills his destiny as the supreme master of this earth and of the lower creation, unquote. Charles Darwin commented, Owen's is a grand paper, but I cannot swallow man making a division as distinct from a chimpanzee as a platypus from a horse. I wonder what a chimpanzee would say to this. Unquote. Incidentally, nobody at the time had any idea what the hippocampus minor actually did. It wasn't until the 1950s that we settled on the conclusion that it was a part of the limbic system, along with its older sibling, the hippocampus major. And as a brief aside, the hippocampus is named after the Latin hippocampus, which was their term for the seahorse, as well as a term for a mythical sea creature that's a cross between a horse and a fish. This was first proposed by the Italian scientist Julius Caesar Arranzi in the 16th century, as he rather accurately noted that the brain parts looked like a seahorse. However, he did not accompany his proposal with a diagram, and in fact, for the next 200 years, there was a fair amount of discourse in the anatomist community about what to call this part of the brain, often by people who seemingly were not aware of Arranzi, and people who had not seen the body part before. Discourse went between cornu eritus and cornu amionis for a while, or ram's horn or Amon's horn, respectively, Amon being an Egyptian god with the horns of a ram. But there was a fair amount of grumbling that it didn't really look that much like any kind of animal horn, as the tip was more wide and rounded and not very good for hypothetically poking things. And eventually these dissatisfied scholars rediscovered Aranzi's idea and also started to distribute actual drawings of the thing, and they agreed it was as good a name as any. However, during this confusion, the German Johann Meyer accidentally translated Gross Fusse des Siebferts as Pes Hippopotami Major, or Hippopotamus Major. This is a wild yet understandable mistake, as Siebferd, or seahorse, has a similar sensibility to the German Nilpferd, or Nile horse, which is their word for hippopotamus. And incidentally, hippopotamus is Greek for river horse, so the Germans aren't really completely out of pocket for Nilpferd, unlike some of their other compound words. And this resulted in what one source described as a grotesque confusion, as the term hippopotamus was occasionally used about this ambiguously named brain component for decades. And a part of me wishes it had somehow stuck and beaten the odds. And just to emphasize, no one at the time knew what this thing did. And since I know you're thinking it, the Potomac River was not named from Greek to translate to river. That is a coincidence. The Potomac is a loose bastardization of an indigenous North American word, as is much of American geographic nomenclature. Also, Johann Meyer did at least redeem himself for the hippopotamus thing 8 years later by realizing that fingerprints are unique, and I do promise that at least one part of this will be relevant later on. So, brief aside over, back to Darwin. Thomas Huxley, a man who nearly had no formal education but did have a position at the London School of Geology, wrote to Darwin, and I cannot overemphasize that Huxley could not stand Richard Owen. He was also not in a great place because his son had recently died, so in order to exact his vengeance upon this man, he seized upon this particular issue of posterior brain horns and began dissecting ape brains to prove Owen wrong, noting, "Before I have done with that mendacious humbug, I will nail him out like a kite to a barn door, an example to all evildoers." He published an aggressive, scholarly attack on the man, claiming vicious falsehoods, and so began an intense and engrossing flame war. British scientific journal Athenaeum began to publish a back and forth between Owen and Huxley, with Thomas maintaining that man evolved from an ape, Richard continuing to cling to his faith that the brains will show otherwise. After a gaffe with inaccurate, mislabeled illustrations of these unique brain parts, Owen maintained his claim despite its grounds now being called into question. In the next issue, upon being asked to respond, Huxley simply wrote, "Life is too short to occupy oneself with the slaying of the slain more than once." Beautiful theory, or otherwise, I suppose. Meanwhile, at the London Imperial College's School of Mines, where, again, he taught, Huxley began lecturing on mankind's connection to the animal kingdom, to the common folk, remarking to his wife, "My working men stick by me wonderfully, the house being fuller than ever last night. By next Friday evening they will all be convinced that they are monkeys. After all," as he also wrote, "it is as respectable to be modified monkey as modified dirt." Darwin, for the record, seemed to enjoy all of this, writing to Huxley, "Oh Lord, what a thorn you must be in the poor dear man's side. I do not believe that in the whole history of science there is a case of any man of reputation getting himself into such a contemptible position. He will be the laughingstock of all the continental anatomists." A nightmare if I ever heard one. But it wasn't just continental anatomists that began laughing at the situation. The entire UK was swept up in this general discourse on monkeys and men, with the great hippocampus question being a particular highlight for his satire and crass cartoons. A published poem, officially attributed to a gorilla, but secretly written by a trustee of the Royal College of Surgeons, went as follows. "Says Owen, you can see, the brain of chimpanzee is always exceedingly small, with the hindermost horn of extremity shorn, and no hippocampus at all." Next Huxley replies that Owen, he lies and garbles his Latin quotation, that his facts are not new, he mistakes not a few, detrimental to his reputation. "To twice slay the slain by dint of the brain," thus Huxley concludes his review, "is but labor in vain, unproductive of gain. And so I shall bid you adieu. Eventually, this made its way further into the arts, with appearances in both a theatrical parody and a children's novel. At the time, there was a famed play character known as Lord Dundreary, a buffoon with airs of intellectualism and class. You probably know the sort. Incidentally, the play that he's from is Our American Cousin, also known as the one that Abraham Lincoln was enjoying during another incident involving antagonism in human brains. Anyway, in this satirical parody speech, Lord Dundreary notes, "We're very much delighted, and I might say quite interested, to find that we all had hippopotamuses in our brains. Of course, they're right, you know, because seeing's believing." As I was saying, we end on a children's book, one titled The Water Babies, A Fairy Tale for a Land Baby. In it, the protagonist is turned into a titular water baby, and a satire of certain leading scientists is unsure of what to make of the situation. Professor Put Them All in Spirits, the resident expert biologist of the book, had not the least notion of allowing that things were true merely because people thought them beautiful. The professor, indeed, went further and held that no man was forced to believe anything to be true but what he could see, hear, taste, or handle. And let's go ahead and enjoy a short reading from the book. And I want to reinforce that this was written for children. He held very strange theories about a good many things. He'd even got up once at the British Association and declared that apes had hippopotamus majors in their brains, just as men have, which was a shocking thing to say, for if it were so, what would become of the faith, hope, and charity of immortal millions? You may think that there are other more important differences between you and an ape, such as being able to speak and make machines, and know right from wrong, and say your prayers, and other little matters of that kind. But that is a child's fancy, my dear. Nothing is to be depended on but the great hippopotamus test. If you have a hippopotamus major in your brain, you are no ape, though you had four hands, no feet, and were more apish than the apes of all aperies. But if a hippopotamus major is ever discovered in one single ape's brain, nothing will save your great 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 greater greatest grandmother from having been an ape too. No, my dear little man, always remember that the one true, certain, final, and all-important difference between you and an ape is that you have a hippopotamus major in your brain, and it has none. And that, therefore, to discover one in its brain will be a very wrong and dangerous thing, at which everyone will be very much shocked, as we may suppose they were at the professor. Though really, after all, it doesn't much matter, because, as Lord Dundreary and others would put it, nobody but men have hippopotamuses in their brains. So if a hippopotamus was discovered in an ape's brain, I would not be one, you know, but something else. I'd like to end with one more note. Huxley's 5-year-old grandson, Julian, saw an engraving from the Water Baby book and wrote a letter to his grandfather. "Dear Grandpotter, have you seen a water baby? Did you put it in a bottle? Did it wonder if it could get out? Could I see it someday? Your loving, Julian." Huxley replied, "My dear Julian, I could never make sure about that water baby. I have seen babies in water and babies in bottles." The baby in the water was not in a bottle, and the baby in the bottle was not in water. My friend who wrote the story of the water baby was a very kind man and very clever. Perhaps he thought I could see as much in the water as he did. There are some people who see a great deal, and some who see very little in the same things. When you grow up, I dare say, you will be one of the great deal seers, and see things more wonderful than the water babies, where other folks can see nothing. I wish I could say that, like his famous novelist brother, Aldous Huxley, Julian went on to do something incredible with his life. Fortunately, I can say that. he went on to be the first director of UNESCO. Thanks for listening. If you'd like to learn more about this, I would recommend feverishly clicking around on Google and Wikipedia like I did. Shout out to Drs. Tatu and Boguslavski at the Regional University Hospital Center in Besançon, France, for their interest in the historical confusion about the naming of the hippocampus. Frankly, I have been failing to finish the script of the next podcast episode for about 4 years now, but I learned all of this on April Fool's Day, and I could not help but share it. So I guess this isn't really the fourth edition of the show so much as the 3.5 edition. I hope you all enjoyed, and maybe someday a full episode of The Will to Believe will reveal itself to me, and then hopefully to you.